Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Robert Dreyfus, who assesses escalating violence in Iraq as the U.S. occupation enters its fourth year. Ned Lamont, a progressive candidate challenging Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman, who discusses his grassroots campaign to oust President Bush's favorite Democrat. And independent energy consultant Joel Gordis, who examines the impact of climate change and destructive weather patterns on the insurance industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The International Criminal Court, or the ICC, made its first arrest in charging Thomas Lubanga, a rebel leader in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with war crimes, including recruiting child soldiers for his militia. Lubanga was first arrested a year ago after nine United Nations peacekeepers from Bangladesh were killed in a firefight with rebel groups in the Ituri district in the war-ravaged northeast Congo. In mid-March, he was handed over to the ICC by the Congolese government in the capital city of Kinshasa. The ICC will try Lubanga in The Hague for enlisting, conscripting, and using children under 15 years of age for his militia, the Union of Congolese Patriots. According to the BBC, teams of ICC investigators were working in the northeast Congo in recent months to investigate the deaths of 50,000 civilians since the civil war in Congo began in 1999. Lubanga's ethnically based militia has battled soldiers from the rival Lendu tribe in Ituri over the region's large deposits of gold. Currently, 17,000 UN peacekeepers are based in the Congo to oversee security for an election set for June. Earlier, the ICC had sought to arrest the leaders of the rebel Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, but they remain at large. The War Crimes Court is also investigating the violence in Darfur, the western province of Sudan, where acts of genocide have occurred. The ICC is not recognized by the United States due to the Bush administration's concerns that U.S. soldiers could be prosecuted in combat zones. In late May, Al Jazeera International, a new 24-hour English news channel sponsored by the Arabic Satellite News Service, will be launched. Already, Arabic-speaking journalists have expressed their fears that Al Jazeera's aggressive style of covering Middle East politics will be toned down to appeal to Western viewers. Funded by the Emir of Kuwait, Al Jazeera has won the loyal following of 40 million Arabic TV viewers, built on graphic images of the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and coverage of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. The new enterprise, Al Jazeera International, will have news bureaus in Doha, Qatar, London, Washington, D.C., and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It has recruited some top talent, including David Frost, Dave Marish, formerly a reporter for ABC's Nightline, and Riga Omar, a Somali-born journalist who covers the Iraq War for the BBC. The news channel, according to managing director Nigel Parsons, will have its own bureaus and original programming separate from Al Jazeera. Yet producers for both networks will share video and do joint planning. The target audience are not just Americans frustrated with mainstream U.S. media, but the growing number of Arab-speaking immigrants in Europe and the millions of Asian and African Muslims who do not speak Arabic. Environmentalists are waging an aggressive campaign to oust California Congressman Richard Pombo, chairman of the House of Representatives Resource Committee and author of a bill to vastly weaken the Federal Endangered Species Act. Pombo, an ally of former House Speaker Tom DeLay, is a longtime incumbent in a conservative-leaning rural district who won 60% of the popular vote in the 2004 election. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, Pombo could be endangered by ethics allegations that have recently surfaced. He took $35,000 in contributions from indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his Indian clients from 1999 to 2004. In addition, Pombo used his influence with DeLay to help squash an investigation of Texas millionaire Charles Hurwitz, owner of Pacific Lumber and foe of environmentalists. Through his congressional career, Pombo, a former rancher, has taken nearly $225,000 in political contributions from real estate developers. In the last campaign, he received $85,000 in donations from oil and gas interests. Pombo is a major backer of opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Already, former GOP maverick Congressman Pete Makowski, author of the Endangered Species Act in the early 1970s, is waging a shoestring primary challenge against Pombo. Environmental groups, including the Defenders of Wildlife and the Sierra Club, plan to spend $1 million to defeat Pombo in 2006. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
On the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, President Bush traveled the country and held a press conference to defend his policy and repeat an optimistic forecast about progress being made in the war. But there are numerous facts on the ground that directly contradict the president's rosy assertions. Iraq's former U.S.-installed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi said of the recent intensification of sectarian violence, "We are losing an average 50 to 60 people, if not more, a day throughout the country. If this is not civil war," he said, "then God knows what civil war is." Timed to coincide with the third anniversary of the war, the Pentagon's Operation Swarmer, involving more than 1,500 U.S. and Iraqi troops and 50 aircraft, was billed as the largest military campaign since the start of the conflict. But reporters on the ground say that the operation, which encountered few if any insurgents, was likely little more than a media show. Meanwhile, the House approved an amendment to an emergency spending bill by Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, that would prohibit the use of funds to establish permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Robert Dreyfus, author of the book Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He assesses the increasing sectarian violence and death squad activity in Iraq as the U.S. occupation enters its fourth year.
Every year since the invasion, things have gotten progressively worse in Iraq, not better. I think it's safe to say that Iraq is now in the early phases of civil war, and I calculate the start of that civil war from the time last summer or last fall, when the number of people killed by death squads, execution, kidnappings, and so forth, mostly by pro-government militias, exceeded the number of people killed by the insurgency. In other words, more people are now being killed in this sectarian warfare through torture, murders, and executions than the resistance is killing. So while the United States is continuing to fight the so-called insurgency, the latest being this massive air offensive that we launch in the area around Samarra, north of Baghdad, Iraq itself is descending into a hell. It's descending into a completely insecure, violence-filled chaos in which there's no security for the people of Iraq. There's no economic reconstruction going on, and each community is arming itself to the teeth in preparation for what looks like the disintegration of the country. So it's hard to overstate how bad things are in Iraq, but in fact, they could continue to get significantly worse.
Robert Dreyfus, wanted to ask you a bit about the death squad activity. I don't know what you have in terms of information on the U.S. connection to these death squads, but can you give us any details as to what is happening there on the ground?
Well, I've been writing about this for a couple of years now. I would say that at the beginning, back when we had the interim government in place and we were creating the beginnings of an Iraqi security force, the CIA and the Pentagon did help to create these so-called wolf brigades and other units within the Interior Ministry, kind of police commando units, that began on a small scale to engage in death squad-type activity. And I think we turned a blind eye to it because we were so obsessed with combating the insurgency. I have to say that now I think it's gotten completely out of hand. The United States isn't behind it anymore, because we're really not behind much in Iraq. The Shiite religious parties that control the government and are not especially friendly to the United States have chosen to vastly expand this death squad activity on their own initiative, probably also with the help of Iran and the Iranian intelligence services. And that activity has actually been, I think, shocking to Ambassador Khalilzad and to some of the military who've tried to clamp down on some of its worst abuses. You'll remember last fall the military uncovered a torture prison where several hundred Sunnis, mostly Sunnis, had been held illegally and were being tortured, and in fact tortured to death in some cases. The military, the U.S. military, has also, on at least one or two occasions, arrested red-handed some of these death squad folks and locked them up. But the situation has gotten so far out of control now, with so many different players in the game, with so many different militias operating and paramilitary forces operating throughout the country, that Baghdad is starting to resemble Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War of the 1970s and 80s. I think it's far beyond the point where it can be said to be under any kind of American control.
As we get closer to the important November midterm congressional elections, what do you think the Bush administration's game plan is in terms of withdrawing troops, even if it's symbolic or a way to stem their losses in the election?
Oh, I don't think they have a game plan. I think they're completely adrift. I mean, their last hope was the December elections, when Iraq went to the polls to elect what was supposed to be a permanent government. The parliament has only met for, I think, half an hour in that entire 3.5 months. They don't have a prime minister. They don't have a cabinet. They don't have anything like a government. So the whole intention of the Bush administration was to allow that December election to create some veneer of stability so that we could start pulling enough troops out to make it look good. Now, however, they're talking about sending additional forces back in, which means that come the elections in November, I think the glaring failure of Iraq is going to be, you know, smack dab in the middle of the television sets for everybody to see. So they don't have any game plan. I mean, I think they're hoping that by some miracle that Iraq will somehow stabilize itself. But with each passing day, that looks less and less likely.
That was investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus, author of the book Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Read his articles online at www.robertdreyfus.com. As Connecticut's junior U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman runs to win another 6 years in office, the image of the kiss he received from President Bush just after the 2005 State of the Union address burns in the memory of many of the state's progressive voters. Lieberman's strong support for the president's war in Iraq has, for several years, sparked anger and talk of mounting a challenge to the three-term senator and 2000 Democratic vice presidential candidate. Ned Lamont, a Connecticut cable entrepreneur, stepped forward to do just that when he announced his candidacy March 13th to oust the conservative Democrat. A graduate of Harvard and Yale, Lamont says he's running because he's tired of being represented by a senator who was not willing to stand up to the president on the war and on the rest of his, quote, wrongheaded judicial, fiscal, and environmental policies. Although Lieberman has a huge advantage in name recognition and fundraising for the August 9th Democratic primary, Lamont is hopeful that his grassroots campaign, being organized by experienced progressive activists, will surprise the pundits who see his candidacy as a long shot. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ned Lamont about his reasons for challenging Senator Lieberman, President Bush's favorite Democrat, and why he believes his campaign is crucial in defining the soul of the Democratic Party.
This is going to be a Democratic seat. And we're a blue state, and I think it's high time that we have a proud Democrat who represent us in the U.S. Senate alongside Chris Dodd. There are a number of issues where, you know, I would challenge Senator Lieberman and think we should, speak more clearly as Democrats in general. You know, it starts off with the war, how we got into this war, how we got into this mess, how our troops are sitting in the middle of a bloody civil war at this point. It says a lot about our fiscal priorities as we spend $300 million a day in Iraq, and we cut back on veterans' benefits, we cut back on preschool and Head Start and student loans and public transportation. And I think we need a senator who stands up for some of the domestic needs we have in this country. And the fact that we're spending the money over there and not over here, I think, says something about our priorities. I think we want a senator who stands up and talks about the illegal wire searches in this country, a president who thinks he's above the law. I think they should be held accountable. Wiretaps are a necessary part of our intelligence, but we have a legal method to do that. Nobody's above the law. So I think we have a lot to talk about in this primary.
What are some of your thoughts about an alternative policy on the Iraq war? Any specific plan that you've come up with or endorsed that would change the course of the U.S. policy over there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, as General Casey said, you know, many months ago, our very visible military presence is fueling the insurgency. And I think it's time for a phased withdrawal of our troops. I'd get them immediately out of harm's way, out of the front-line positions. I think it's time for the Iraqis to take responsibility for their own destiny. I agree with some of the comments Chris Dodd recently said, that, look, well, they've got a few weeks, a month. They've had plenty of time to put their unity government together. Let's give them a little more period of time, and if they can't do that, they're looking at the abyss, and it's time for our troops to head to the periphery. And I think I agree with that.
Aside from the Iraq war, what are some of the major issues that you feel, as a senator representing Connecticut, you would champion?
I think I would put health care and education at the top of my list. Everywhere you go around our state, you see health care as an issue for individuals who are paying more and more for health insurance and getting less and less care. I'm a small business person. I can tell you the cost of health care is crushing for us. And when we lose bids to fly-by-night companies that don't even offer their employees health insurance. It's a cost that's slowly beginning to bankrupt the state government and federal government, and we've got to figure a better way to deliver quality health care to all of our citizens.
Ned Lamont, what's been the degree of support you've gotten from local politicians and nationally for people who may disagree strongly with Joseph Lieberman, acknowledging, of course, he's an incumbent and has a lot of power?
Well, Scott, as we go around the state, all four corners of the state, I'm going to a lot of the town committees, meeting with concerned citizens, talking to folks that haven't seen a U.S. senator for a long time, I might add, and there's a real energy out there. There's a real grassroots support. They think every 18 years or so, let's have a real debate. Today, we've got some big issues that ought to be debated within the Democratic family, you know, starting with the war in Iraq. So I'm getting a lot of support there, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we'll be able to get our 15% at the convention and allow us to keep going on to the primary.
The primary is in August. What's your trajectory from here on into August? What kind of activity are you going to be doing to garner support statewide?
I'm going to town committees all across the estate. I'm introducing myself, making sure they know who Ned Lamont is, why I'm running for Senate, why I feel so strongly that we got to take our party back for Democrats. And see if we can make a real change down in Washington, D.C. I just believe that the Bush policies have been so harmful to our state and to our country. You know, from there, we've got thousands of people have signed up at nedlamont.com as volunteers. One of the first things we're asking volunteers to do is help us with a petition drive so we can get 15,000, 16,000 signatures of registered Democrats. That will allow us to go to the primary, and that will allow us to go into the convention saying, look, we've got grassroots support for this primary. Now I'm looking for your support as well.
Ned Lamont, many progressives I speak with are very upset about where the Democratic Party is lately. They don't see it as having, quote-unquote, backbone in challenging some of the policies of the Bush administration. Certainly, I think Joseph Lieberman is one of President Bush's favorite Democrats, as I've heard it said, and I know you've repeated. What has to happen within the Democratic Party to really take the mantle of, quote-unquote, opposition party back?
I think we should be a constructive opposition party. I think we should talk clearly what we believe, where we think America ought to go, and how we should get there. And sometimes our voices are muddied, and I think Senator Lieberman muddies our voice in the war in Iraq and America's proper role around the world, for example. I think it's time for the Democrats to talk clearly in terms of what we should be doing. And in terms of what our priorities are, I mentioned I think health care, universal, affordable health care has got to be a priority. also mentioned the schools. It's so key that all these kids get on board and believe again. We have to have a public education system in our communities where kids can get a good, proper education, where our schools become community schools. We have preschool, and we also have programs after school to keep them off the streets, to keep them learning so that they're inspired. We get these guys as active members of our society and our workforce in the years ahead.
That was Ned Lamont, Democratic candidate challenging Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman. Contact the Lamont campaign by calling area code 203-622-7091 or visit their website at www.nedlamont.com. In another sign of the times, the insurance commissioners of all 50 U.S. states voted unanimously in early March to set up a task force to look at the impact of climate change on the insurance industry and its consumers. The action was prompted by the last two hurricane seasons in the U.S., which resulted in a record $30 billion in insured losses in 2004 and as much as $60 billion in insured losses from Hurricane Katrina alone in 2005. Last year was also the costliest year in weather-related natural disasters on record, according to a recent study by the Munich Re Foundation. Reinsurance companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re underwrite the risk of insurance corporations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joel Gordes, an independent energy consultant who's worked since 1994 to determine the impact of climate change on the insurance industry. He talks about the schizophrenic nature of the business and how natural disasters are leading to a re-evaluation of some of the industry's business practices. He begins by explaining that damage due to flooding, which was determined to be the major cause of much of the destruction from Hurricane Katrina, is not covered by most insurance policies.
Many of the losses were due to floods, and unless people have special flood insurance, it is not covered by your private insurers. In Europe, it is. That's why they look at it a lot more seriously over there. Certain things like the wind or driven rain because of the wind, those sorts of things are covered. However, just straight floods are not. So there's huge payouts anyhow, but not because of the flood aspects.
Where do insurance companies fit into the concerns about global warming? They're looking at it, obviously, from a business perspective, right?
Of course, everything is going to be bottom line. But, you know, the insurers are a very, very conservative group. And basically, they are going to rely upon the financial tools that they have always relied upon. And that's basically things ranging from actions such as raising the premiums, raising deductibles, pulling out of certain areas, just plain making the decision not to insure them. Coastal areas where they're prone to great amounts of storm surge and damage, certainly are areas that they try to get out of. Now, the problem is sometimes you get a gutsy insurance commissioner. For instance, the insurance commissioner of Florida during the 1992 Hurricane Andrew, when the insurer said, we're not going to insure coastal areas in Florida, said, well, then you're not going to insure anything in Florida, and basically told them, you know, you do the coastal areas and the rest of the state. But they did, in Florida, for instance, have like about 9 insurance companies go bankrupt because of Hurricane Andrew. They have seen the effects of large storms. Now, the secondary question here is the linking of any given storm to global warming is sort of a no-no in scientific circles. You cannot say this storm is linked to it. Now, if you start looking at overall trends and scientists talk in terms of likelihoods, probabilities, statistical types of things, and they say in a global climate changing world, the intensity of the storms will probably be more intense, but they have been perfectly mum in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as far as the frequency. So we can't outrun the science at this point that's put out by the IPCC.
What's the significance of the concerns of these very conservative business people in raising the profile of climate change?
They don't want to lose money. I think it comes down to their bottom line. And, you know, insurance companies are interesting because the people on the property law side don't often talk with the investment side. There's two parts to almost every insurance company, those who do the assets management and invest money, and those who do the risk aspects of it, of insuring things. And too often they don't talk to each other. So, you know, you might find the asset management people investing in oil and coal and other things, whereas some of the people on the other side of the business may cringe a little bit at that. But it's like, I think they really need to get their act together and align their investments with the policy that is best for themselves and their shareholders.
Joel Gordis, there's a lot of scientists and environmental activists who believe that global warming is happening and are trying to raise the alarm. But even if the insurance industry isn't officially aligned with these other groups, what role does it see for itself in sounding the alarm also and maybe convincing the government to take some steps that maybe scientists and environmentalists haven't been able to convince the government to do?
Sure. It's interesting that since 1995, the United Nations Environment Program has sponsored a financial institutions group on climate change, and the insurers were the first to start issuing statements. And their statements were very strong even then at the reinsurance company level. And so they have made certain statements. I think we need to see a follow-up in action. And there's been some limited actions. Swiss Re has been part of a group to begin investing in sustainable energy sources and such. But we're not seeing a large-scale type of position on that. The other thing Swiss Re has also talked about is withdrawing or not providing directors and officers insurance to certain firms that do not have carbon mitigation plans. That's a pretty powerful incentive. I haven't seen it invoked yet, but when they do that, I'm pretty sure that that will get the attention of much of the business world.
That was energy consultant Joel Gordis. Contact his group, Environmental Energy Solutions, at area code 860-561-0566 or visit their website at home.earthlink.net/TildaJGordis. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.